you a high performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Mind Body Peak Performance. This week, I've got a different one for you. What if all the therapies, the supplements, the nutrients, the vitamins, the minerals, all the healthy habits you're doing are actually setting you back further? Well, that's exactly what we discussed today with our guest, Dr. Michael Biamonte. He's the founder of the Biamonte Center for Clinical Nutrition. He's also the co-creator of BioCybernetics, which is an unprecedented computer software program that's able to study blood work, mineral tests, and many other lab tests to determine exactly where your body is imbalanced. As a 30-year practitioner, he's dedicated to improving the lives of his patients and helping them get back to living. He's a professional member of the International and American Association of Clinical Nutritionists and is a member of the Scientific Advisory Board for the Clinical Nutrition Certification Board. He is listed in the Directory of Distinguished Americans for his research in nutrition and physiology. As you'll learn in this conversation, this being Candida, the topic of the show, is one of the first places you'll want to start in your quest to better health. Once your gut is healthy and you clear any dysbiosis, you rebalance your microbiome, then all the health habits are actually benefiting your health. You can find all of the show notes and the links to resources we discuss at mindbodypeak.com/90. If you find this as eye-opening as I did, I'd love it if you would share this with your friends, your family, or anyone you think could use this information. Candida and gut dysbiosis is one of those topics that's not sexy, but can make a huge difference once properly addressed. Okay, sit back, relax, and enjoy this conversation with Dr. Michael Biamonte. Dr. Biamonte, it's great to have you on the Mind Body Peak Performance podcast.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Let's start out today with something from your area of expertise, and that is Candida. Can you give us some insight as to why this is an important topic?
The reason why is because it's virtually unknown to most people, and it's not on mainstream. And the problem is that it affects probably 30 to 40% of the people at any given time. If you were just to randomly survey people or test them, I guess is the best word, you would find probably 30 to 40% of the people who you randomly test have Candida and don't know it, and they're being misdiagnosed and mistreated by their doctors.
So we're going to talk a lot about Candida today in our conversation. It's your specialty, so it seems perfect. But before we get started there, what are the non-negotiables you've done so far today for your health, your performance, and your bioharmony?
Well, I think one of the things we'd have to put in first off is, as far as food goes, it's eating organic, non-GMO food. There's just no way around that. Regardless of what area you're looking at, what subject, what illness, whatever, non-GMO food is essential. GMO food is poison. It's banned in Europe. Monsanto, the company that makes GMO food, doesn't allow it in their own cafeterias in Europe. So what else could I say?
I didn't realize that. I had no idea that Monsanto actually banned it in their own cafeterias.
It's pretty sick. But, you know, this is the situation we have. It's strictly money. You know, there's all the jokes about follow the money and you find out what's really going on. And nothing is more true than this when you're dealing with this subject. The GMO foods have been banned throughout Europe. In Italy, they don't even know what it is. You ask them, where was this? Where do you get this food? And they point to a mountain. somewhere, you know? So, and it's been proven time after time, your body doesn't really recognize GMO foods as being legitimate foods. There's trouble. And because it has trouble with that, it sets off all types of DNA problems in terms of your body coping with it. So it's just, regardless of your illness or your problem or where you are health-wise, you really want to avoid GMO food and stick to organic food.
Yeah. I really like the concept of food being more than macros and micros and phytonutrients, but also as information through the microRNA, which within 15 minutes of eating a meal enters our bloodstream and makes epigenetic changes and exosomes and different things like that, that really show the importance of the quality of the food and the way it's cultivated makes a difference. I know that there's plenty of people out there who go to Italy or one of these places in Europe where the GMO foods are banned, glyphosate is banned, and they remark how much better they feel in their, how they're able to consume gluten and wheat and grains, and they can't consume those here in the States.
Still shocks me, because we're operating here under the model that you assume the candida patient can't tolerate any of these foods. And yet when they go to Italy, and exactly what you're saying, we find out that they can. But strangely enough, when they're here back in the United States and they try the same experiment, once again, they have difficulties. And that's because of the overall burden that they're getting. You know, you can say, well, I could tolerate wheat and gluten in Italy, so why can't I do it here in the United States? Well, it's because in the United States, you're also getting hit with a lot of other GMO foods that you're not aware of that you weren't getting hit with in Italy. So,
one thing that came onto my radar really for the first time was gut dysbiosis. I read Dr. William Davis's book, Supergut, and Healthy Gut, Healthy You, and a bunch of these different books, and each one built upon the last and increasingly convinced me that I need to pay attention to this. And I think in his book, Supergut, he mentioned the stat that like 90% of Americans have some form of gut dysbiosis, candida being one of those.
Mm-hmm. I'm being very conservative when I say it's probably 30 to 40%. That's 30 to 40% of the people who would have an outstanding illness that's related to it. There are probably, this is true, that maybe as much as 90% have some type of an imbalance. It may not be so strong as to cause their diagnosed medical illness that their insurance company is paying for, et cetera, but they definitely have some type of imbalance, and it's causing a lot of the non-optimal symptoms they might have, like chronically feeling like they wake up with a cold, which is a very common symptom in people with candida, or people with allergies, aches and pains, all the non-optimal things that people just assume are normal can go away when they do a proper balancing of their dysbiosis, because of how the intestinal tract and the intestinal health affects so many different things and you would never think. As an example, neurotransmitters are regulated to a large degree by your flora. We know how neurotransmitters work in the bloodstream. We know about serotonin and all these different things, but what's not known is that your flora heavily affects them. And this is why for years I've marveled that when people who were very constipated, when they would come to me and I would put them on a program and I would fix their constipation, one of the things they would always give me as a win from doing that was the fact that they feel less depressed. Mm. And that's because their neurotransmitters were in better balance as a result of handling that. Women with PMS, again, with some type of constipation, when their bowels normalized, their PMS got better. And I could just keep going on and on into these different areas, but the gut health affects a lot of different things you would never think that it would. Only from looking at it with rear view mirrors will you ever appreciate it.
Let's take a step back, Dr. Biamonte, and let's talk about candida, what it is, and why you chose to specialize in candida specifically.
Well, why I chose it is because it became a mystery, and I become obsessed with finding out how you unravel this mystery of candida. But candida is a normal organism that's found in the digestive tracts of all mammals. It's a fungus, but it also is a yeast. It's dimorphic, which means it can live in two different states. And it's part of your normal flora, although it is very minor, has a very minor role. But nonetheless, it is normal to find some. And this is where you can get into claptrap arguments with medical doctors when you're trying to explain candida, because they'll say everyone has it. And this is true. Everyone does have candida. But when we talk about candida, we're only interested in overgrowth of candida. We're not interested in normal levels. Normal levels don't cause pathological changes in the body. It's the overgrowth of candida that does. And candida is normally controlled by your flora. Your beneficial flora controls candida, and all the good bacteria that makes up your beneficial flora keeps candida at to a very low level. It's when this is disrupted. It's kind of like you can even think of it as like the food chain of organisms in your intestines becomes disrupted because the friendly bacteria actually use candida as a sort of food. So when this chain of balance or dominance becomes imbalanced, when candida becomes more dominant than it should, it starts to become a pathology, and it releases all sorts of different toxins into your body. It releases alcohol into your body. There are strains of candida in Japan that can legally cause someone to be drunk by legal limits because it produces so much alcohol. Candida releases mycotoxins, which are basically fungal toxins. It releases neurological toxins. It releases a host of chemicals which cause all types of symptoms. The range of symptoms you can get with candida, depending on how you want to list them, could it be anywhere between easily 75 or 150 different disrelated symptoms. It could be something like you have a rash. Rashes can be caused by candida. If you go on the internet and you do a Google search for psoriasis or eczema and candida, you come up with hundreds of thousands of documents. Allergies are caused by candida. Chemical sensitivities are caused by candida. Mast cell activation is caused by candida. It just goes on and on and on and on what candida can cause, because it's essentially like having this huge parasite living through your digestive tract that's not only interfering with your absorption of nutrients, but at the same time, it's throwing tons of toxins into your body that your body then becomes unable to handle because you don't have the nutrients anymore to function correctly. It's diabolical.
It's like the perfect storm, the Trojan horse that not only does it like inhibit your ability to absorb things that you consume and making it more difficult to provide the nutrition your body needs to actually optimize all the different bodily processes that occur, but then it's also dumping a bunch of different toxins into your bloodstream.
Trojan horse is a very good way to put it. I totally agree. Yeah, it's diabolical. It's worse than parasites, you know. I've had a lot of, over the years, encounters with treating people with parasites and studying parasitology. And I'd have to say that candida is worse because parasites don't release the amount of toxins that candida does. Mm. And when you look at it as just to review for a second what we just said, candida being its own parasite and the fact that it blocks and robs your own body of nutrients, that means your body doesn't have the B vitamins and the amino acids to make glutathione. Yeah. To go through different detox processes. So then on top of that, to add insult to injury, now it dumps all these toxins in your body that you can't detoxify because it's taking away what you need to function.
Wow. How pernicious. I want to go back to something you said earlier, and I want to double click onto the dimorphic nature of candida. What do we know about that? Is it more dangerous when it's in a certain state, or if we test, is it going to be only found if it's as a yeast or in the fungal form?
That's a good question. Where it is in the body is what determines the state that it's in. For instance, like in the vaginal area, in the mouth, in the throat, it's mostly would be picked up as a yeast. Mm. When you get in deep into the intestinal tract, you can find yeast forms and fungal forms. When you look in your lymph system, you're going to find it in the fungal form. And then when you look into different glands or organs where it may have pervaded, you're going to find it in the fungal form. On your skin, you're going to find it in the yeast form. On your nails will be in the yeast form. Men who are in the jock area will typically find it in the yeast form. Mm-hmm. But the reason why it's dimorphic in the first place, what it's doing is it's trying to evade being killed by your immune system or by medicines that you use. So this is a primeval mechanism it has where it flips itself from a fungus to a yeast like a chameleon just to try to avoid being destroyed. It doesn't necessarily know so much why it's doing that or what it's doing, but that's a chameleon mechanism it has.
There's so many different mechanisms in the way it works. It seems like for such a simple organism, it seems like it's very advanced.
Yeah, it's not. There's something to it which is spooky. One of the things about it that I'm fascinated with is the fact that people who have bad candida will crave sugar. Now, no one has ever been able to document why that is. Like, what is the mechanics of that? No one has been able to ever lay it on the table and say, here is why people with candida will crave sugar. It hasn't been done, but yet they do. And yet what's interesting is that sugar is one of the fastest fuels of foods you could give candida. Mm-hmm. So when you look at all that, you start to wonder, wow, you know, what's really, how is this able to do this?
It also just makes you wonder about your cravings and if they're really you or it's your microbiome that's making you crave those certain foods instead.
That's a really good point.
So is that why it's been like so largely ignored and it's really flown under the radar? Because over 75 to 150 different symptoms can actually be a problem with candida and they just appear as everyday symptom?
To be very blunt with you, I believe that the reason why it's ignored is because it's essentially a doctor-induced disease. Iatrogenic, the word iatrogenic means doctor-induced disease. And candida falls under that category because most of the people who have candida have it from either abusing or taking some kind of medication which causes it to come about. It is true, it naturally occurs in people in certain circumstances. Women who have excessive estrogen levels will get it, you know. So there are natural situations. However, the majority of the people that most functional doctors will treat develop their candida from taking antibiotics, number one. That's the top reason you get it. Also from taking antacids. Most people don't realize this. Anything that cuts your stomach acid down will enable candida to grow because your stomach acid helps maintain particular range of pH in your intestines, which is beneficial to your good bacteria and not to candida. So we can go down a list of all medications that cause candida, and this is what you end up finding out. So now here's the second problem. If the medications that doctors typically prescribe cause it, why would they want to then embrace this as a problem and start treating people or acknowledging it? It's really not to their advantage to do this, even from a legal liability standpoint. So if someone was to come out and proclaim that antibiotics are the reason why you have your chronic fatigue syndrome or your arthritis or whatever it is because you have candida, you imagine the lawsuits that would start?
What's the time duration? Say I take a course of antibiotics and then I increase my susceptibility to candida. Am I expecting to like start feeling new symptoms maybe like a month later or 6 months later? How does that work?
It's a very good question. And that's one of the reasons, again, why candida gets overlooked. It's because it's a very slow process. And some women who take antibiotics and suddenly get a yeast infection vaginally are very lucky because they're seeing it right away. But in most people, it doesn't happen that way. In most people, it's much more slow and insidious in terms of its growth. So the person may take the antibiotics, and after taking the antibiotics, they may notice they don't feel as energetic or as peppy as they had. That's usually the first step of candida growth. It starts to drain your energy and slow you down. Now, either the person takes another course of antibiotics a year or two later, or they do something else which further injures their flora. Now they're starting to have digestive problems. They're having gas, constipation, things like this. Then it advances to where now maybe they start developing rashes a year or two later. So it's over the period of years it advances, and it starts to bring these symptoms to bear, which you're not going to connect. Like, how would you connect being tired with the rash you have?
Yeah, very difficult.
This is why it's so sneaky. And then we go into allergies that people develop, and then eventually people start to develop chemical intolerances and chemical sensitivities. People with really severe candida can have it so bad where they can't even go out of the house. They can't work. They have to stay home and, in their particular environment, which they usually, from the mother of necessity, they'll have their whole house rearranged so that they're not being bombarded by chemicals that are bothering them. They'll notice, well, you know, this thing bothers me. They cut that out. Then a couple of months later, something else they'll cut out. And it goes on and on. And we call these people universal reactors, because they can't tolerate, they're totally overwhelmed by their, as we said initially, they're overwhelmed by their ability not to be able to process and handle environmental toxins, and by the fact that candida is also dumping them in their body at the same time. So you have this very wide range here. You can have the person go from being fatigued to then being homebound because he can't go out. And then all these things in between. So they're all they would all appear to be disrelated to the average person. And that's where it's trouble. It's because the person's not recognizing the fact that these actually may all be one source.
Well, I think by now we're starting to scare people. And there are solutions out there, such as some of your work and your book, The Candida Chronicles, lays out a game plan. But are there any diagnostics that people can do, either like lab tests or maybe symptoms that are highly correlated with candida that wouldn't otherwise present themselves?
There are two things I recommend people to do. The first is if they want to consider they might have this, I recommend they sit down with a piece of paper and they come up with a time when they were feeling fine, before all their problems came about. And they kind of want to make a timeline of how their symptoms developed and look for, in this timeline, a point where just before some symptoms started, they took antibiotics or they happened to encounter any of the things that might cause candida. Like, did they chronically start taking antacids? Did they get on some kind of hormonal program? Did they take antibiotics? Were they in an accident? Did they have a surgery? Because with accidents and surgeries, it's not only a trauma to the body, but you're going to be taking a lot of antibiotics. So do this and then see if it any of it makes sense, if you can correlate your symptoms or your chronic problems on this timeline with these events. The next thing they can do is they can go try to get tested. Now, testing is not that plentiful, unfortunately, like it is for other problems, but there do happen to be a few tests that are valid for candida. One of the tests is an organic acid test. It's done by the laboratory called the Great Plains Lab. Yeah. And they do the organic acid tests will have about 10 different markers for candida. And that's a legitimate test. They can try doing stool tests. Big problem with the stool test is that candida, like many parasites, often don't make it to the lab in time for them to be able to duplicate it in the test. Mm-hmm. When you take a stool sample, the stool sample is put in a little vial, and it usually has formaldehyde in there and other chemicals to preserve it. But by the time your sample gets to the lab, usually your own digestive enzymes and juices, which are still in that stool, have digested the parasite and the parasite eggs to the point where it doesn't show when it gets there. And the same thing is true. The candida doesn't show anymore. So you have to have somebody skilled in interpreting the stool test. Mm-hmm. And just to give you what the Reader's Digest version of this, the bottom line is when you do a stool test, if your microbiome shows an absence of friendly bacteria, right then and there, that's an automatic diagnosis that you have candida. Now, there are other parameters we look at too. There's a whole list of parameters we look on the stool test to diagnose candida without actually seeing it. But that's the major thing right there. If you have an absence of friendly bacteria, that friendly bacteria is what stops the candida from overgrowing. So the odds are is if your friendly bacteria is low or deficient, the candida has overgrown. You should expect not to find candida in a stool test when you do it. People are shocked when I say this, but that's because it's just the inadequacies of the testing using stool make it so. If you do a stool test that looks for parasites, and it's particularly a 2 or 3 day test where you have to collect a sample for 2 or 3 days, they're going to do a microscopy study. So they're going to look at the stool under a microscope, looking for the eggs of the parasites. And when they do that, they'll observe whether or not they find dead yeast. And it will say right on the test, dead yeast. And it will give you many, moderate, few, none. If you find some dead yeast there, that's another way to determine from a stool test that you have candida. Because if they find dead yeast, that yeast was alive very recently.
Is yeast not naturally occurring? Like, should you not expect to see some yeast?
Well, yeast would be candida. So no, you shouldn't. There shouldn't be.
But if it's in a healthy balance, wouldn't you see some?
No, that's not. I know where you're going with this, and that makes sense. But that's when you're looking at a microscopic study for yeast. No, because for even few is too many when it comes to what you're seeing in a microscope compared to other organisms. When you're doing a culture, it's different. On a culture, minimal amounts of yeast or candida are acceptable, but not when it comes to the microscopic study.
Okay, gotcha. So what I've heard you say so far, Dr. Biamonte, is that the main causes are antibiotics in some form or shape, whether it's taken for an illness or it's for a trauma, or if it's not necessarily antibiotics, the other big part is hormones. What about just like consuming a bunch of sugar in your diet?
Well, normally food and diet wouldn't be a cause because your protective bacteria also feeds off sugar. A lot of people don't know this. It's why they say you'll see certain acidophilus preparations actually have sugar in them because the sugar feeds the friendly bacteria as well. So typically that wouldn't be the case. It becomes the case, though, when you're dealing with somebody who has a lot of excesses going on. And excess is not just with sugar, but then with alcohol and other drugs, prescription or otherwise. That's where you can then get into that realm. But typically your diet would have to be very bad for quite a while before that occurred. That's not something we would normally project. But you see, in a person like that, who has a very bad diet, high alcohol consumption, all kinds of drugs, it's not going to take too much to tip them over the edge.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I guess what I'm hearing is antibiotics and then stuff that interferes with normal digestion, say that's acid blockers or proton pump inhibitors, right, that kind of thing. And then those are the big ones. And then also there are other things just accelerate the development and can like further compromise the bodily systems that are responsible for keeping the candida in balance.
We can tag on to this. It's anything that disrupts your flora. See, because now you can go into a swimming pool and you could unfortunately ingest a lot of chlorine water and you have the same problem. You'll develop. Now, if you're a swimmer, let's say you go to a swimming pool once a year. Well, that's not a big deal. But if you're somebody who goes frequently to a public pool or a pool that's chlorinated and you're ingesting a lot of the water over time, that's going to kill your flora. So that's why we'd have to open this up to say it's anything that could disturb your intestinal flora will bring about the candida.
Okay, so I'm starting to see a much bigger picture here, and it seems like there's a lot of things that could do that. Are there any things that you personally do to protect yourself against this? Like, of course, the chlorine exposure is inevitable at certain pools, and there's a lot of things in life that disrupt normal flora. So what's your approach personally?
You know, here we go again. We're back to the very first thing we talked about. It appears that eating non-organic GMO food is another thing that can disturb your flora and aggravate candida conditions. So that makes it even more interesting when you're trying to do everything right. You're trying to avoid all these things, but yet again, it goes down to the food you eat. As we see this all the time, that people who eat, they think they may be eating well, but they're eating GMO foods and they develop candida as a result of that. So that's very sneaky when that occurs in the case. And then unfortunately, if you've had COVID, We've found beyond a shadow of a doubt that COVID can cause candida, as can other illnesses. It's not just COVID, but other illnesses, like if a person gets Epstein-Barr virus, they can develop candida. But one that really came out from right field to hit me, which I didn't expect, was the vaccine. The famous controversial COVID vaccine will cause candida. We've had many, many people who had completed our program, were free of candida for years. They got vaccinated and they came back to us saying, you know, geez, I got vaccinated. And since I got the vaccine, I feel like my candida's back. And sure enough, when we tested them, their candida was back.
So is it causing it or is it like laying dormant and then these different things can like reactivate it?
I would have to say that's a very good question because I come into this very, very often when I deal with patients who being treated by other practitioners, because they're not accurate or they're not precise in what they do, they end up reducing the candida to the point where the person thinks it's gone, that gets labeled as gone because there's an absence or a reduction of symptoms. There's a lack in most cases that I've seen of documentation of the person's candida, the documentation of it being there and it now being removed. So in that case, there's a very high possibility that it's just laying dormant and it's being brought back out to the point where the symptoms now make it recognizable again.
Okay, that's very different. What's the traditional success rate in treating candida? And then what's their process and how does your process differ?
Traditional. Boy, that's a good, that's, you know, over the years, since Dr. Truss first wrote one of his books about candida, or the early books about candida came about, I'd have to say the traditional treatment of it probably would be the use of the diet, the low sugar, low carbohydrate, you know, low gluten diet also, and then the introduction of nystatin. Nystatin probably is the most used drug for candida. So I'd have to say that's one model of a traditional treatment. There's never been anything standardized. I've tried to do this and still are, but there's no standardization in terms of this treatment. So the medical model for treating candida from medical doctors who recognize it in their patients would probably be nystatin and the diet. And I would say the success is probably zero because these people constantly relapse. And one of the reasons why they relapse is the typical use of nystatin is to give it to the patient for 3 to 4 months. And here you now run into one of the first things I write about in my book is that when you take any antifungal, whether it's prescription or herbal or natural, for more than 21 days, the candida begins to mutate and become drug resistant to it. Oh. So you may take the nystatin for a few months and you may reduce the volume of candida and reduce the symptoms. But now what you're left with is a drug-resistant strain, which in due time is going to come right back. And now the nystatin won't work on it because it's mutated.
So you might have early success by taking nystatin and following the traditional diet.
Because you're going to reduce the overall population of the candida while it's mutating and becoming drug-resistant.
And then it comes back with a vengeance, and it's much harder to treat after that.
There you go. Yeah, so that's the medical model. And I would have to say that in the nutritionist world, the alternative world, the model is not that much different. The only difference is that they employ things like oregano oil or powdered arco or herbal remedies, which have an advantage in that they're more broad spectrum. So if the person happens to have certain harmful bacteria and parasites with the candida, the nystatin and the medical drugs won't affect those, but the natural ones will. They will help reduce those other organisms. But you still run into the same problem of mutation and the candida going through its steps to become drug resistant. It happens that it starts at about 21 days. Hmm. Candida has a set of cells. We refer to them as mother cells and daughter cells. And after about 21 days of being exposed to the same medication, the mother cells impart DNA information to the daughter cells about the medicine, explaining to the daughter cells how to grow now into mother cells and avoid being killed by this medication. So whether you're dealing with a pharmaceutical product or a natural herbal product, the same thing happens. Mm-hmm. But you know, of course, the alternative practitioners and functional doctors tend to be much hipper. And they understand that you also want to try to replace the missing acidophilus and the missing probiotics and whatnot. But because they still violate some basic tenets of handling this problem, they still end up with the same kind of situation where the person's constantly relapsing. Like the typical person who comes to me tells me the story that they've been fighting this for 10 years. They've seen at least 15 different doctors and they get better for a while and then they relapse. And it's the same story we hear constantly.
So what's your difference there then? If you're not following the same model and if they're violating one or more major tenets of this, do you have anything that you do differently?
Well, this is what my book explains. The reason why the book is called The Candida Chronicles is because it chronicles my adventure, if you want to put it this way, of investigating candida and unraveling all the mysteries of it. Because with the average person who tries to treat candida, they come up with so many floorboards smacking them in the face that they don't know really where they're walking or moving about in order to handle it. So when you go down the list there, I'll shoot out some of the basic ones here for you. One of the first problems or mistakes is in not rotating the antifungals that you use. When you use the same antifungal day after day, you end up with this drug resistance issue that I just spoke of. My solution to that is we rotate antifungals. We give the person maybe four different antifungals. They take them 4 days each. And we continue doing that until we have the desired result from that set of antifungals. That stops the drug resistance.
Why is it 4 days each?
Well, the first group of antifungals that we give people, we use 4 days because 4 days is long enough to get the desired effect from the medicine, but it's not anywhere nearly approaching that 21-day point. Mm-hmm. But also, there are different attributes to the medicines that we'll use. Like some of the herbs that we use may have certain antibacterial properties or antiparasitic properties. So we want to intermingle them so that any of the other co-organisms, like in Lyme disease, you would call it co-infections. The same thing is true with any type of dysbiosis. You have co-infections. You have bacteria like Klebsiella and Citrobacter and Pseudomonas, which are living with the candida. You have parasites like Giardia and amoebas and different types of hematodes that are there in the same fashion. So you want to flip these herbs around so that you can wipe out as much of the candida and the cofactor as you can. Then we move with the second set of antifungals to 7 days because these antifungals address the candida, which is lying very deep in the intestinal tract. And they need longer to get in there. You could think about it in terms of literally soaking the intestines with these antifungals so that they can kill the candida that's deep-rooted. And that candida that's deep-rooted in the person's gut is the same candida that repels probiotic, which brings us to the next factor. If it was true that taking probiotics would eliminate candida, you and I would not be having this discussion. There is truth there, but that's not it. But that's what's portrayed. So what occurs in real life is that when you take the probiotic and you have candida, the candida repels the probiotic. Mm. It literally pushes it away from the lining of the intestines and stops the probiotic from being able to stick to the lining of the intestines. So you're taking the probiotic and you feel better temporarily because the probiotic, when it's in your intestines, will drop the pH of your intestinal tract. That's one of the main functions of probiotics, is to keep your pH of your intestines somewhere between 6 and 7, 7.2, somewhere in there. So while it's there, it's helping to lower the pH. Just think about this for a second. Acidophilus. Let's take the word apart for a second. Acidophilus. The name is giving away one of the functions right there. Acidophilus, which is the key probiotic to your small intestine, releases acids. And the acids keep your pH in a certain range. And these certain microorganisms can't live outside of a certain range. And candida and probiotics share that. So giving someone a probiotic as their main treatment for candida, or in the very beginning of the candida treatment, doesn't work. This is a common mistake. But it's taken with this confidence based on what we know theoretically about what the probiotics do. But it doesn't work. So this is what I discovered, is that probiotics only work after you've reduced the candida to a certain level. Then they're able to reattach themselves to the lining of the gut if the probiotic is what we call human strain or sticky strain. Which is, sticky strain is an industry term. Human strain is the technical term. And there are many probiotics made by companies which are not human or sticky strain. They're totally legitimate probiotics. The problem is they're not of the strain which happens to be able to stick to the human intestinal tract. So there we have two problems right there. Drug resistance, and we have the probiotics being misused. Now the next thing we have is nutrients that are being taken with candida. When people see functional doctors and well-meaning holistic doctors, they're apt to try to cover as many bases as they can, which is logical. If you have a deficiency of something, they want to fix that because they know the deficiency can't be helping the situation, if we just want to be very simple about it. The problem is certain medications that kill candida do so by blocking the candida's ability to absorb nutrients. So we back a little bit off from this. two examples are vitamin D and iron. The two most popular candida drugs work. Their mechanism is to stop the candida from absorbing iron and vitamin D. So now I pose to you, if this is true, is it a good idea for a candida patient to take iron and vitamin D if they happen to be low?
No.
It doesn't make sense, does it? But yet you'll find many patients with candida low in iron. Why are they low in iron? The candida is who's getting their iron. Now, if you want to give them more iron, who are you giving it to?
Candida.
Right. So this is why on my program, we're very precise about what we give people and what we have them take or not take. So we don't have them take iron, vitamin D, B-complex vitamins, coenzyme Q10.
Oh, wow.
There's a whole list of vitamins that make candida worse. That if you give these vitamins to the candida patient, they actually get worse from you from taking the vitamins. The next set of problem areas with nutrients are antioxidants. See, most medications and herbs, for that matter, they work by creating oxidative stress. We've all heard that term. Oxidative stress is basically where you're basically throwing a handful of free radicals at something. And these medications create free radical damage to the outside membrane of the candida or whatever the organism is you're trying to kill. And that's how it works. So if you take antioxidants at the same time that you're taking these antifungals, they negate the antifungal. They act as a remedy or an antidote because they're going to reduce the oxidative stress that medicine is trying to create against that organism.
What about some of these herbals that are touted as antifungals? And when they're derived from like natural food sources, I would imagine that sometimes they have, say, vitamin C in its natural form present also.
Yeah, but they're not high enough to cause this problem. That's the interesting thing. Even some of my medicines that I've made that we use on my program that kill candida have certain antioxidants in there, but they're not at a high enough dose to act as a remedy against the actual antifungal property. They're there to assist. There are different ways that those nutrients can assist the function, but when they reach a certain dosage, it's a problem. Then they're acting as a literally like a remedy to the problem.
Okay.
These are some of the highlights of somebody reading my book, some of the main discoveries they'll make about what people do wrong. There's a lot of other ones, but those are some of the key ones. And some of the ones that I, in a way, are kind of the most humorous because you have people doing things which it seems very logical to do, but unless you really know candida, unless you've made an in-depth study of candida, how it operates and whatnot, you would never know that this would make the condition worse.
Yeah. And even a well-meaning, well-trained expert looking into like the organic acids test, they see your results and they're like, okay, I see deficiencies here, here, and here. I'm going to address those and then we'll get to the candida. And if they do that and they see you're low on, say, vitamin D or whatever it is, whatever the lab marker shows, they can actually be fueling the fire.
Yes, this is true.
Wow.
This is true. And people are apt to want to resist this because they don't want to stop taking their vitamins because they have maybe experienced improvements from vitamins in the past, or they have there's a trust factor in taking them. But when they do, most of them, 90% of them will say, well, I can't believe I actually feel better not taking my vitamins. Oh. But that's only true. Now, this is not a mandate against taking supplements or vitamins. This is only true in the case of the person who has acute candida that you're treating.
Well, I also wonder then how many times people have candida and they don't even recognize it. And they're taking these supplements that are supposed like health supplements that are like widely touted as beneficial. And yet they stop taking them and they remark that they feel better.
Yeah, this is that's a whole other interesting. We could do a whole show on that because there's a few reasons why that could be. The first one would be candida. Is that the supplement they're taking is aggravating candida? The second one could be that they have low stomach acid. People with low stomach acid very typically have bad reactions to taking medicines, whether they're prescription or just supplements, because they can't process them. And the other thing comes into when you start studying synergy between nutrients or the non-synergy between them, then you start to encounter a lot of these things. I'll give you some examples, but most people don't know this, but all vitamins and minerals either have certain nutrients they support and they're synergistic with, or they're actually working against.
Yeah.
So when someone takes vitamin C can lower copper levels in the body. Now, the symptoms of copper deficiency and vitamin C deficiency are almost identical. Vitamin C also forms, copper also forms one of the enzymes that helps utilize vitamin C, as does manganese. So if you take large amounts of vitamin C, over time you could cause a manganese or a copper deficiency. Copper is an antagonist with iron and zinc. So if you take large amounts of copper, you can reduce your zinc levels and your iron levels. Now we can go on and on. Every nutrient that anyone names, I could explain to you which nutrients work synergistically with that or which ones are antagonist to it. And this is another reason why this can happen. A person could be taking all these different supplements that he reads about, and they all sound good for his problem. But because he knows nothing about his biochemistry, he doesn't know that he's apt to be a little bit low in one or the other or something. And then he takes something which further aggravates the problem.
What role does genetics and, I guess, epigenetics play in candida?
Well, there are certain people who genetically are more susceptible to it. And those are people who tend to have collagen errors. Because when you actually get down to looking at candida and what it does, how it lives and whatnot, it basically is an organism which lives on your mucous membranes. So your mucous membranes, you have to then look, there's a collagen that's there. So the health and the resilience of your collagen is very involved with how prone you are to having candida be able to stick to the gut lining and not be removed by normal processes in your digestive system or by your own immune system. Mm-hmm. So it can have a significant, very significant. There's one particular SNP, MMP-1 is the name of the SNP. And this is a SNP that I've found people with chronic candida and acute candida will have often. And because MMP-1 is a collagen error, it allows them to relapse with candida more easily without necessarily them having done anything wrong. It just is a weakness in their collagen and the mucous membrane's ability to resist the candida.
Hmm. And for someone like that, would it make sense to supplement with glutamine or something like that that'll help improve the mucous membrane strength or maybe even collagen?
Yeah, actually yes. But specifically for that gene area, it's the pycnogenol family, which helps strengthen the collagen. That's the deficit that MMP-1 causes in those people. Okay. That is handled more from the pycnogenol family than other areas. But you're not incorrect. It's those people do need more support than another would need.
Yeah, it's knowing your own deficiencies and doing what you can to mitigate them.
Mm-hmm. We're back to copper again. Copper is another nutrient which heavily supports the collagen formation and health. But again, copper is a volatile nutrient because it's an essential nutrient, but at the same time, it could become a heavy metal if you have too much of it. And it's one of the nutrients that you'll tend to find people with candida elevated in. When we finish handling the person's probiotics and their probiotics are back to normal, the first thing we look at in the chronic candida patient is we look for any toxicity in their body. Metal and non-metal toxicity, because those are the things that also make a person more susceptible. And very often you find in autistic children and you find in people who with chronic candida, very elevated copper and mercury. Those are the two most common metals that are elevated in those people. And you find that they have adrenal insufficiency and thyroid. You can pretty much guarantee that anyone who's had candida chronically also has, they're suffering from adrenal and thyroid insufficiency, and most likely heavy metals where you're dealing with arsenic, copper, mercury, and a few others. And those are underlying factors which make the person more predisposed to it coming back. So you've got to, as part of your candida treatment, once your candida is under control, your probiotics are back, that's where your attention has to go. It has to go on what are the other factors in this person's body which will make them more susceptible to a relapse of candida. And this you're going to find always. You're always going to find adrenal insufficiency and thyroid insufficiency. Now, it doesn't mean their blood test shows low thyroid hormone. What it actually means is that their thyroid hormone is not going to be utilizable 100% by their bodies because their mineral receptors have been thrown off. This is something you can go to Park Avenue and talk to every thyroid specialist. They're going to look at you like you're a nut. They have no idea of what you're talking about because they only understand certain aspects of thyroid function. When you get into the cellular aspect of how your body uses the thyroid hormone on a cell level, now this is where a nutritionist is actually the most hatted in this because all of that function is based on nutrients and nutrient receptors. And the pattern you're going to find over and over again in the candida patient is their adrenals are down, their thyroid is down. Very often they have high copper, high mercury. That's a very common pattern.
Would you see that reflected on any of the proxies of thyroid function? Are there any biomarkers that you'd see that on?
Unfortunately, and most of the time it's going to fly under the radar because that's not reflected by thyroid hormones in the blood. You see, your thyroid gland's ability to make hormones is separate from your cellular recognition of the hormone and its ability to utilize the hormone through the electron transport chain, which is where the thyroid hormone enters. So a nutritionist who's taking nutritional tests may observe on a test this person's copper is elevated, or they may observe that their ratio in their cells of calcium to potassium is off, which is the thyroid ratio. In the book by Guyton's Physiology, Guyton is like the father of physiology. And in his book on physiology, he wrote that in some ways not fully understood yet, calcium desensitizes your cells to the effects of thyroxin, where potassium sensitizes the cells to it. Now, stepping back from there, we know that copper enhances cellular retention of calcium and zinc enhances cellular retention of potassium. So then you end up with this ratio, calcium and copper versus zinc and potassium. And that ends up being the mineral receptor balance for thyroid hormone. There are other things that could interfere. Mercury also downregulates the thyroid gland and downregulates the hormone, but that's not considered to be normal because mercury is not a physiological nutrient. Say mercury is a toxin. So we have to keep that out, but we will mention it because it can interfere. It can jump in here. But it's that ratio. So you're only going to see it if you're looking at the mineral ratio. But how you can tell, which I think will answer your question, is by your body temperature.
Oh.
Quite a few books have been written, starting with Broda Barnes, wrote a book called Hypothyroidism, the Unsuspected Illness. And in that book, Barnes explains how taking your body temperature is a more accurate way of understanding your thyroid function than your blood work. Yeah. Because when you take your body temperature, you're looking at the end result of the entire process of your body utilizing your thyroid hormone. You have a thyroid hormone, so you produce heat and energy. So when you look at your temperature, if your temperature is chronically below 97.8, that would be somebody who functionally has low thyroid, regardless of what their blood test says. Then if you look into what we're talking about here, this is what you're apt to then find in this patient. You're apt to find all these trace minerals in their cells imbalanced to the point where their cells are not utilizing the thyroid hormone. It's not that their gland is not making it. It's not being utilized. And doctors who only look at blood work and only look at hormone levels, how could they possibly know anything about this? They're not looking at it.
Yeah. So the issue here, in like layman's terms, is that it's not the hormone production or the concentration in the bloodstream that is always the issue. It can also be a dirty cell receptor, so to speak, or the inability to actually bind to and utilize that hormone.
Exactly. And if you're not looking, if you don't know about that, and you're therefore not looking at that, looking for it with the appropriate tests, you'll never know and it never gets addressed.
Yeah.
This is where you get people with low thyroid and the doctor puts them on thyroid medication, or let's say they have thyroid cancer, they have their thyroid removed, they end up on thyroid medication, and they always tell you the same thing. They say, I feel better being on the hormone, but something is still not right. I still don't feel normal. And that's because all these other factors are not being addressed.
Well, Dr. Bimonte, there's a lot I wanted to discuss with you, so maybe we'll have to do a follow-up around two here. But my other main question that we've now alluded to and referenced several times in this conversation has been about co-infections and heavy metals and candida. What's the link there?
That's a really good question. The link is essentially that the heavy metals make someone more susceptible to the chronicity of something like candida. Candida would be considered a chronic infection, but if you have heavy metals, the chronic state is more difficult to reverse.
It's the heavy metals that increase susceptibility to candida, but it's not that candida increases your propensity to store heavy metals rather than detoxifying them.
Unfortunately, that's true. It's a two-way street. Oh. Because when you have candida, it would mean the bifidus bacteria in your colon is disturbed. Now, when people start studying phase one and phase two detoxification, one of the things that you learn is that in phase one detoxification, your bifidus bacteria in your colon works directly with your liver to help you detoxify. Now, if you have candida, it means your bifidus is compromised. Everyone in terms of detoxification always thinks of phase two and glutathione. That's the popular one. But phase one and bifidus are there. Hmm. So yes, so if you have candida, your ability to detoxify heavy metals is compromised. So you see how it becomes this catch-22 that you have, you're compromised in detoxing the metals. Now you get the metals, they accumulate, and they aggravate the candida through all different manners. So this is a problem. And then there's the co-infection issue. Kind of colors the entire thing. You have variations that occur depending on your co-infections. This is why you never get a patient usually with the same exact symptoms as the other, even though candida is their main problem, because they have co-infections, or everyone has a co-infection of sorts, which brings about its own unique symptoms with it. So when you combine all these things, you get the individual.
The co-infection occurs alongside candida. And sometimes, like, I'm guessing a co-infection, or I guess a pre-infection, will increase your susceptibility to candida as well.
Because again, it's disturbing your flora. To be politically incorrect, a person goes to another country where maybe the hygiene isn't so great, right? They end up getting Montezuma's revenge. They get food poisoning. They get whatever. Their flora is disturbed. Now they come home. They get treated maybe for the acute symptoms of this protozoa they picked up or this bacteria that they picked up. Fine, they get over that. They're not throwing up, having diarrhea anymore. But now their flora was disturbed. Now they start developing candida.
So it all really goes back to that flora.
The disturbing, yeah. This aspect of it, we could have thrown into the same bag that we had in the beginning where we were talking about what can cause it. Is having these types of situations where you get this acute food poisoning and it disturbs your flora. That is a co-infection that falls under the heading. It's a co-infection, but at the same time, it's a causative factor too.
I just had that exact experience when I went down to Mexico City last month. And what can we do to prevent a candida overgrowth, or to reduce the likelihood of a candida overgrowth post-acute infection like that?
You would want to hope, first of all, that you've eliminated the base infection. And if the basic infection's eliminated, then you want to jump on taking probiotics and things like Saccharomyces boulardii, which helps to also negate a lot of these organisms that cause diarrhea in particular.
Yeah.
So that's what you would want to do as fast as possible. It's also soil-based organisms help. Because they physically digest these organisms before they have a chance to get out of control.
Okay, there's some ideas right there. But we are running out of time today. So Dr. Biamonte, if people are interested in working with you directly or finding your work, your book, how can they find you on the internet?
Very easily, just Google my name. We have three websites. We have the New York City Candida Doctor. We have the New York City Thyroid Doctor. And we have health-truth.com, which is our main website. They can also find us on Instagram and on Facebook.
Are there any final takeaways you'd like to leave listeners with?
It's very important when people start taking nutritional programs and they get into really in-depth programs that they get tested. Testing is a very important, always has been a very important aspect of what I do. Because when you don't test someone, you don't really know what you're doing. You have to have tremendous experience, like I do, to be able to navigate somebody through some type of program without testing. And even then, I will be up at night wondering if I did the right thing. So you have to have a test. You have to have legitimate testing that tells you whether or not what you're taking is correct. Because as we said before, vitamin C can cause a copper deficiency, and the deficiency of copper is virtually the same symptoms as vitamin C deficiency. Quick story I'll tell you. When I first started practicing, a medical doctor came to me who had a prostate problem. And he had read that zinc was important and helped prostate. So this medical doctor started taking 50 milligrams of zinc a day. In a couple of months, his prostate problem got better. He never stopped taking the zinc. He continued to take zinc every day. Mm-hmm. His prostate problem came back after about 3 years, and he sought me out. And he told me the whole story, and I told him, stop taking the zinc, start taking copper. Within about a week, his infection reversed. We had him do a hair test, and sure enough, his hair test showed he had driven his copper all the way down. Now, copper helps your body defend bacterial infections. So what happened was, from his repeated use of zinc with no copper, he caused a copper deficiency, which allowed a prostate infection. The same thing he originally treated with the zinc. But because it's the medical viewpoint of, you know, you take the one thing, you say zinc is what does it, so I'm just going to take zinc, I'm not going to look at anything else.
It's all about understanding the interactions and the synergies between different ingredients, and that's a whole study in itself, very difficult to do. So thank you for sharing some of your wisdom and expertise today.
You're more than welcome.
I'm Nick Urban, here with Dr. Michael Biamonte, signing out from mindbodypeak.com. Have a great week and be an outlier. Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.